chair for Elizabeth Kowalski, and I'm here to announce the defense of Beth's thesis. And I'd like to share with you something that Josh Billings said, and I think this had to do with completion of dissertations, although the exact citation was not clear. What he said was, consider this postage stamp. Its usefulness lies in the fact that it sticks to one thing until it gets there. So, picturing that situation. Beth came here several years ago as a paleoceanographer, and she completed a degree in the geology department, a master's degree there, and then wisely saw that her interests really lay in terrestrial plants. And both her personal and her professional interests actually lie in terrestrial plants. And she's been working in Ecuador for several years in a basin where fossil plants were known to exist, but nothing had actually been presented in publication form on those plants. She turned her interest then from paleoceanography to interpretations of climate based on fossil plants. And she's also interested in how plants are affected by mountain building. And she's taken advantage of the sessile nature of plants. Rather than being constrained by the sessile nature of plants, she's taken advantage of that to determine paleo environments of the past. So how does that actually work? Well, I think Willa Cather actually explained this again in a single sentence. What Willa Cather said was, I like the trees because they seem more resigned to the way they live than other things do. And I think Beth will explain how that actually works a little bit more clearly. So, you know, let Beth go ahead.
Thanks, Robin, for that introduction. I guess I have to, for the first time.
Is that working?
Yes.
Sorry. What I want to start with, basically, is to say that you know, Robin has been working in South America for a long time now, and you know, she sort of disappears for a while at a time. And I've gone down with her a couple of times, and one of the things I've noticed is that every time she introduces herself to people down there, she says, my name is Robin. People kind of look at her funny because Robin's not a real common name in South America, and she'll say, you know, like Batman and Robin. So if I could have the first slide. I finally figured out exactly what Robin's been doing down there in South America every time she goes, and it turns out that she's been hanging out with Batman. And I think, actually, that with this light here, you can't see very well. Could you get that so that we can see this line? Sorry. Instead, you get to see Batman and Robin for quite a while now. Okay. So obviously I cut and paste, but I just couldn't resist. So we'll get into the talk now. Obviously every dissertation that you go through as a graduate student, you have to thank a lot of people to get you there. So first, I'd like to thank my committee, chaired by Robin, who definitely helped me through quite a bit. Others on my committee who helped me as well are Rick Madden, who's from Duke University, Bill Anderson, who's in the biology department, works in the herbarium, Bruce Wilkinson, Catherine Badgley, and Peter Wilf, all in geology. And they made up my committee and helped me just tons on this defense. Also have to thank a few people who helped me in the field get all my fossils. Jim Kowalski, my dad, who I dragged along as a field assistant 1 year. I'd recommend that to anybody. Your parents as your assistants, it's wonderful. Gabe Bowen, who I dragged another time down there, followed me around and took notes. Dan Cheney, who came at the beginning, the very first trip to the Nibong Basin with me and Robin and collected just tons of fossils. He's great at it. And Bill Sanders, who showed me how to use the AirScribe, and without it, I would never have nice, clean fossils to study. So thanks to them. I also need to thank the Ministry of Agriculture in Ecuador, who gave us fossil permits to collect and also to allow us to bring the fossils back to study, and the Herbaria of Michigan Field Museum and Católica University in Quito, who let me use their herbarium specimens to compare to fossils and also to score for some of the other work I did. And of course, every graduate student has a slew of people behind them to help just discussing their work
helping them day to day, and these people are mentioned here. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. One of the things about coming and taking time off is that everybody that was here when you got here is gone by the time you finish. So there's many, many other people I didn't mention that also helped me through. And then also my family, especially my husband John, and my family and my in-laws who were there with a lot of support. So now we'll start. So today what I'm going to talk to you about is the middle to late Miocene environment of southern Ecuador. And in particular, what I'm going to do is use fossil plants, sort of like Robin said, to get up the temperature and elevation of a particular basin called the Nuevón Basin, which is located in southern Ecuador. So just to orient you geographically, this is South America, a topographic map of the continent. You'll see that the Andes Mountains run along the whole western coast of South America, all along here, the whole length of the continent. And just as an aside, the Andes mountain range is the longest mountain range in the world today. And what we're going to do is we're going to focus in on one area in Ecuador here in the northern Andes. So now we're drawing in a little bit on the northern Andes. And what I have shown here along in Ecuador and Peru are a number of intermontane basins that formed and filled during the Miocene, during the initial uplift of the Andes mountain range. And these basins are basically all similar in age, and they're all filled with many, many plant and animal fossils. And the basin that we're going to talk about today is the Nuevón Basin. It's this very small basin located here. And a couple of the other basins in this area as well, we've collected fossils from and are in the process of studying as well. So at some point, you might be able to get a really robust picture of what's going on in this area. Here's a picture of the Nuevón Basin. It's approximately 120 kilometers square. And the basin sediments were deposited over a period of approximately 4 million years, starting 13 million years ago in the middle Miocene and ending about 9 million years ago in the late Miocene. And there are several types of deposits that are located throughout the basin. There are many sequences that indicate syn-eruptive deposition, such as this, which is basically ashfall. There are also lots of riverine sediments. These are a wide series of channel fill and overbank deposits. There's also a couple of coal layers in here. And these have abundant plant fossils deposited throughout. And finally, there are lacustrine sediments located in one area of the basin. And this particular site comes with its own fossil collectors. So this slide will basically set up what the rest of the talk is going to be about, the broad questions for this talk. We know, and the bottom isn't focused very well, but we know that basically 23 million years ago when the Andes started to uplift, that the whole area of northern South America was basically lowland tropical rainforest, and that's what it says, even though it's hard to see. And the Nuevón Basin, which is what we're going to be talking about, is located geographically approximately here. This would be the Pacific Ocean, and the Amazon Basin is this way. And we know that during the early Miocene, this whole area was tropical lowland forest in a couple of ways. Several researchers have looked at the plant fossils that are found throughout the northern Andes earlier than the early Miocene and have found that they're typical lowland tropical rainforest and other types of forest that are lowland. And also, throughout the northern South American area, there's extensive deposits of marine sedimentation, which indicates that there were marine incursions happening during this period of time. It means that the whole area was low enough to have marine waters come in and not drain off immediately. So we know that it was pretty low during the early Miocene. This is a cross-section of the Andes today, where the Nuevón Basin is. And you can see that it's a lot higher. The Nuevón Basin is approximately 2,500 meters above sea level and on the western edge of the Andes mountain range in Ecuador. You can see, based on this diagram that I've shown, the different vegetation zones as you go up mountains, that it's montane forest, basically, today. And if you go out into the Nuevón Basin now, you'll see that it is indeed montane forest. And down by sea level and in these lower areas up to approximately 1,000 meters, you do get tropical lowland forest, and the intermediate is the submontane forest. So how does this set up what we're going to talk about? Well, you can see I've got two time slices, the present and
the early Miocene, which is when uplift began. So what happened in the middle? What did it look like? How high was it? What was the temperature like? I mean, today, the Navone Basin is at 12 degrees Celsius, which, for comparison, Ann Arbor has a mean annual temperature about 9 degrees Celsius, so it's a little bit warmer. But we know if it was tropical lowland in the early Miocene, it had to have been a lot warmer than that. So what temperatures were we at in between? What elevation were we at? What type of vegetation existed in the intermediate? The Navone Basin, which was deposited between 13 and 9 million years ago, will allow us to sort of see where exactly we were in the sequence between lowland and upland for the Navone Basin for one specific time slice during the uplift of this basin. So how are we going to do that? We're going to look at plant fossils. There are very numerous localities in this basin that give you beautiful plant fossils. Some are very well preserved, others are not. But just to give you a few examples of the types of fossils that we find here, this is probably a member of the Fabaceae, which is a bean family. We also have leaves that are toothed, like this here. See the teeth along the edge. This is a member of the Proteaceae, which is the same family that macadamia nuts are in. And it's very common in southern hemisphere floras today. And here's another one, a member of the Cecropiaceae. It's a South American and African family that's very common and tend to be pioneer trees. So the way we use the plant fossils to estimate, first paleotemperature, and then we're going to get into elevation from there, you can do one of two things. One is you can use leaf morphology of your plants to determine temperature. And the way you do that is basically by looking at the characteristics of the leaves that you have in your flora. And as Robin had mentioned earlier, plants, because they are sessile and they don't move, are thought to have evolved so that they can fully exploit their environment. The way the leaves and the trees look is helps the plant to fully exploit its environment. And so what you would expect is that leaves would look different in different environments. So what we do is we use that relationship between the shapes and sizes, the leaf morphology of these leaves, and climate to determine what the climate was in that area. The second way that you can figure out temperature using plant fossils is using the nearest living relative technique. And what this is to what you do for this is you take all of your plant fossils and you figure out the species that you have in your flora. And then you figure out the closest modern species, the one species that is related most closely to that species. You take the modern plant and look at its climatic tolerances, and then you infer that the fossil species, because it is so closely related, has the same climatic tolerances. And if you combine a whole bunch of these together, you can get an idea of the temperature or elevation or rainfall of the fossil flora. What I'm going to present and what I've done for this thesis is the leaf morphology method of estimating paleotemperature, mainly because the taxonomy of the fossil plants in the Navone Basin are not well known, and so we can't really use the nearest living relative technique. So if you go outside in Ann Arbor in the summer, a lot of the plants that you're going to find look something like this. You might recognize this as a silver maple. And you'll notice that there are lots and lots of teeth on every single one of these leaves. If you look around a little bit more, you'll also notice that many of the other plants that you see in this area have lots and lots of teeth on the leaves as well. Turns out that leaves with teeth on them are very common in temperate, cool environments. However, if you go to a warmer environment, say Florida, south of there, what you'll find are fewer and fewer plants with teeth on the leaves, and more plants with entire margins, like these plants here, like this, which is a magnolia. So basically what we see is just a sort of observational trend as we just look at the plants. Turns out that this relationship, though people have noticed it for approximately 80, 85 years, was first quantified in 1979 by Jack Wolf using East Asian data. And what he did is he plotted up the percentage of species in any given flora with entire margins against mean annual temperature. And lo and behold, that observation that people have been having for the past 85 years holds true, that indeed, when you're up at high percentage of high mean annual temperature, you have high percentages of entire emerging species in your flora. So it turns out that not just margin state changes with climate, there are other aspects and characters of leaves that you can use to determine climate. And what I've got here are just a few different leaves to sort of point out some of the different characters that you can look at. One of the characters is the leaf lobed, like this leaf is, or not. Obviously margin state. There are other characters you can look at with the teeth. Are they irregular, like the teeth here? Were they more regular than this? Is it long and thin, like some of these leaves? Is it short and squat, like this leaf is? Other aspects you can look at are the base of the leaf, the apex of the leaf, its overall shape. Is it widest in the basal part of the leaf or widest in the middle part of the leaf? And many different equations have been calculated that use up to 31 different characters that you can look at from a leaf. Not every leaf obviously has every character, but there are 31 different ones that people have looked at to compose different predictive equations for temperature. So there are many leaf characters you can look at, but if you want to look at the relationship between climate and leaves and leaf morphology, you want to look at specific areas. And right now, there are many different equations that have been put forth in the literature to determine temperature, and they come from databases that have data in them from different regions in the world. And you see that lots of the world is not covered here. That equation I showed you earlier was from this region here. All of the data came from East Asia. And these purple areas, which have floras in them that are all in the CLAMP database, which is what it's named, is the one database that is used primarily when determining, calculating temperatures to determine, calculating equations to determine temperature from leaf morphology. And I'll just point out that the area that we're interested in, which is the Navone Basin here, is in an area in northern South America where there is very little data collected for these databases. You can see some in southern South America here, I mean in central South America. But in northern South America, there's very few data that's collected. So the first question I asked was, which published regression equation should I use in order to determine the paleo temperature of the Navone Basin? So what I did is I composed a data set of 30 modern floras from South America, and I went to the herbarium, and from herbarium sheets, I scored every species that I could find in the herbarium that was listed for each one of these 30 sites, and I got the species lists from the literature. And I got a whole lot of sites from Ecuador, basically, because that was my primary region of interest, but I tried to expand it through most of northern South America because I thought it would be interesting and it would increase the data set. And the data that I collected from these 30 sites I used to test published regression equations. I tested 17 either equations or methods of doing it, and there are four types. I tested 8 simple linear regression equations that use one character to determine temperature, to predict temperature. And most of those use the percentage of species with entire margin, which is what I had shown you with that first graph, to predict temperature. Two others use leaf size as their predictive character. I also tested several multiple linear regression equations. All the multiple linear regression equations are derived from data from the CLAMP database. That was the purple database in that previous slide. And they use different numbers of sites from that database and different numbers of characters to predict temperature. I also tested canonical correspondence analysis, which is a multivariate ordination technique. And that uses all 31 of the characters that have been scored and that I scored from each of the floras. And the final method that I used was correspondence analysis, which is followed by a nearest neighbor resemblance function. And I'll just call that nearest neighbor from now on. Basically, it's a multivariate ordination technique very similar to canonical correspondence analysis, but instead of using the results of all of the data that you put into the equation to determine the exact value of temperature, you use only the 20 sites that come out close to your test site in order to determine it. So the idea is that you'll get a better estimate of temperature if you're just using the sites that are close to yours physiognomically. And this is a really busy slide. I'm just going to point out a few things from it. What this is are the results of the 8 simple linear regression equations that I tested. Along the x-axis is the observed temperature, the actual temperature of the site. The y-axis is the predicted temperature, which is the temperature that I got after running it through the equation with the leaf morphological data. The diagonal line is the line of unity, and the dark line, which is hard to see here, is the standard error of the equation. And I've plotted it this way. A better way to plot it would be to put the standard error bar on each point. But for a slide like that and with so many points, it would be really difficult to see which points fell with the error bars over the line. And so this is just an easy way to see whether or not the sites fall within the standard error of the equation. So you can see there's a couple of trends I'd like to point out. I'm not going to go through all of these, but I'll just point out that the sites with high mean annual temperature tended to be predicted within this clump here, so that some of the sites are predicted accurately within the standard error of the equation, and others tend to be either pretty much overestimated or underestimated. You'll see that two of these equations actually do a pretty good job, these two here, with the high temperature sites. The other thing I'd like to point out with these is that these 5 sites here are overestimated by every single one of the equations. Although these 2 equations that were down here tended to do a little bit of a better job predicting those. And these 2 equations down here are not using percent entire margin species in the data to predict temperature, but instead leaf size. So these 6, you can see that when you're just using the percentage of entire margin species, they do a pretty bad job of estimating the temperatures of these low temperature sites. And just in case you're curious, that one equation or graph I showed you earlier that showed the relationship between mean annual temperature and percent entire margin leaves is this one here, and you can see it does a pretty bad job of estimating temperatures in South America. Here are the results of the multiple regression, the canonical correspondence, and the nearest neighbor. And you can see basically that the trend is the same. You get a big clump in the high temperature sites, and then the low temperature sites are all overestimated again. And here again, there are a couple of equations that do a pretty good job, at least at the low temperature, at the high temperature sites, but not at the low. So just to sort of give you an idea of why that might be, this is a really busy graph, but I want you to concentrate on these blue X's here, which are, this graph is again mean annual temperature against percent entire margin species. And what I have is that CLAMP database, which are these open circles, and then many of the other databases that were used to create the equations that I tested. And I'll point out these green diamonds, which are the Australian data set shown there. And I'll just show you one thing, which is why I think all of these, especially low temperature sites, are overestimated, is that in general, you can see that at any given temperature, these South American sites tend to have a higher percentage of entire margin species than other sites from different databases. And because of that, these sites tend to be overestimated when you run them through equations based on this data here. And I'll just point out as well that it turns out that all of these sites in particular from South America are high elevation sites. They're low temperature and high elevation. Because I'm going to be trying to figure out the paleotemperature of an area which was experiencing uplift, and I don't know what elevation it was at, I think it's important that any regression equation or other method of determining temperature that I use to determine paleotemperature of the Nippon Basin takes into account sites at all elevations, so that I can predict temperature at these low elevation sites as well as the high elevation sites. And so instead of picking one of these equations, I decided I would create my own, since I had now 30 sites worth of temperature and leaf data. So these are the same 30 sites earlier that I had shown in red, plus 1 very dry site in Venezuela that I added, and 12 sites from Bolivia that were scored by Kate Gregory. since they fall in the same space that I had been pulling out, thought it would make a more robust data set in order to include her data. The first thing I did is try to do a regression equation that uses mean annual temperature against the percentage of species with entire margin for just South America, figuring that it might work. Turns out, though, that it doesn't, and this is the slope of the line, the regression line that you get if you run that calculation. You'll see that there's a huge scatter. The R-squared for this line is about 0.49, so you see it's not a real good correlation between the two. And you'll notice, or I noticed something when I looked at this, which is that the sites tend to fall into three groups. You have this group up here, which are all the low elevation, high temperature flores. This group here, which are high elevation, low temperature flores that are dry. They have low amounts of mean annual precipitation. And this group here, which is high elevation, low temperature, and they're very wet. They have very high amounts of mean annual precipitation above 100 centimeters, and actually most of these are above even 200 centimeters of mean annual precipitation, whereas these sites here have less than 100. And I can basically see that because they're falling in these different groups, this character in particular did a very poor job of estimating mean annual temperature of all the sites in this group. So what I did do was take all of my leaf character data and the climate data that I had, and I decided that I was trying to calculate a multiple linear regression equation because one character didn't work. I thought maybe combinations of characters would. And I started with all 31 characters and eliminated many of them, either because they weren't correlated with mean annual temperature at all, or very poorly correlated with mean annual temperature, or because they were highly correlated with another character that was better correlated with mean annual temperature. So what I ended up with was a small number of characters that I thought would predict mean annual temperature. And I'm not going to get into how I decided that this, in the end, was the equation I've chosen. I did many, many, many calculations trying to get the best mean annual, best multiple linear regression equation. What I've chosen is one that uses three characters out of the 31 to predict temperature. And the characters are teeth close, which is basically leaves that have teeth that are close together as opposed to far apart. Mesophyll 1, which is a leaf size character. It's leaves that are approximately 6,000 millimeters square. And length to width, less than 1:1, which are leaves that are broader than they are long. And what we end up with is an equation that you can see, for at least the low temperature sites, does a fairly good job of estimating temperatures of some of the sites and not others. But you can see that it doesn't overestimate all of our sites, which is nice, because now we can actually use this equation to estimate temperatures at any elevation. You can also see that up at the high temperature sites, which are low elevation, it does a pretty good job, brings that in and more accurately predicts many of those sites. Just to let you know, even though it looks like there are a lot of sites in here that are not predicted well, still 72% of the sites were predicted within the standard error of this equation, which is 2.6 degrees Celsius. Now, one other thing to mention about this is that mesophyll 1 and length to width less than 1:1 have both been used in other regression equations to predict temperature in the past. However, the departure with this equation from any equations that have been done before is the use of the character teeth close instead of percentage of species with or without teeth. And I'll just explain why I think that is. And you'll remember in the last slide that there was a grouping of sites based on their amount of mean annual precipitation when you use the character presence of teeth. However, if you plot up those same sites but use teeth close, the number of species or the proportion of species that have teeth that are close together instead of just that have or don't have teeth, they draw them in and they form one clump instead of the two separate clumps. And so I think what we're saying here is that teeth close is a character where at low and high precipitations at high elevation, they're very similar, whereas percentile margin is dissimilar. Therefore, it's better to predict temperature from that character than percentile margin. And the combination of these characters together does a better job than any one character does for South America. So now we've moved back to the Navone Basin. We're no longer just in all of northern South America, but again in Ecuador. This is the southern end of the Navone Basin. We're going to use the temperature predictive equation that I've just explained to you to predict temperature and then eventually elevation of the Navone Basin. So what I have are plant fossils from 25 localities in the southern end of the basin. They run through two formations, but we won't be looking at all of those formations today. So the nice thing about the Navone Basin is that many of the layers have been dated, and we can place the plant localities within a stratigraphic framework that's been dated. The dates here are argon-argon dates that were done by Madden and colleagues several years ago, and I've plotted them up on the stratigraphic column here, and you can see that at least the plant localities that I'm going to be looking at were deposited between 12 and 11.2, 11.3 million years ago. One thing you'll notice here is that I don't have all 25 localities on here. The reason is because predictive equations that you use to estimate temperature have high errors when the number of species that you use to predict the temperatures is low. And so what you should ideally have is 20 species in your flora or more. The reason for this is just that if you have a small number of species and you find another plant fossil of another species, the amount of change that species introduces is pretty high, and so therefore your temperature estimates are going to change a lot in between the estimating temperature from the first flora and estimating temperature with the flora plus the one species. When you have higher numbers of species and you add one more, the percentages of any given character don't change that much, and so you don't have as much of a change in temperature. So basically your error goes down the more species you have to predict temperature. And so what I did is for several stratigraphic layers, like here where two plant localities were very close together stratigraphically, I combined the species in each one so that I would have higher species total, and I did that up here too. And then took every stratigraphic layer with 15 or more species in them and use that to determine temperature. And I realized two of these don't have 20. Povey et al. Have suggested that you only need 15 in order to have suitable error estimates, 15 species in your locality. But today I'd say the consensus is probably 20. But I'm confident that the error introduced by the low numbers of species here is not real high, mainly because the diversity of these places is pretty low. I haven't found a lot of new species every time I've gone. So if we use the temperature equation that I calculated from the modern neotropical sites and calculate temperature at the four stratigraphic levels, here's the strat column just for reference, you'll see that what we have are temperatures that decrease as you go up section. I'll just point out that this is high temperature and this is low temperature down here. And just to point out as well, this one site in red at the bottom is from a site with only 12 species, so the error is really high in this one site. And I'm not going to be talking about that site at all, but I'm just illustrating it just to show you that if I did extend it out a little bit, you'd end up with the same trend, but you can sort of ignore the one in red. So what I found is that as you go up section, the temperature of the Navone Basin decreased from approximately 22 degrees Celsius up to 16 degrees Celsius, so it's a change of about 6 degrees Celsius. So now we have a temperature estimate for this basin. We need an elevation estimate for the basin, or we'd like an elevation estimate for the basin, so how do we do that? Well, it turns out there's a really, really good correlation between elevation and mean annual temperature in the neotropics. Once you get out of the neotropics, you also have to take into account latitude. That influences temperature as well. But when you're in the neotropics, you can discount latitude, and you'll see that the mean annual temperature changes very well depending on what elevation you're at. The lapse rate, which is the change in temperature as you go up in elevation, is globally, if you average it globally, is about 6 degrees Celsius per kilometer. And many people, when they try to determine elevation using temperature, use this global lapse rate. But I felt that because lapse rates can change depending on where you are in the world, a better estimate of the elevation in this area would be using a lapse rate from sites in the neotropics. So what I did here is I took elevation and mean annual temperature data from 467 neotropical climate stations and plotted them up, and got a lapse rate of 4.68 degrees Celsius per kilometer elevation you go up. So you see it's a lot different. We get very different elevation estimates if we use the global average lapse rate. And this equation actually has a very small standard error because it's so significant. And other methods of determining elevation tend to have much higher standard errors. So using that equation on the temperature estimates that I got, used the equation that I calculated before, I estimated the elevation of those same four stratigraphic levels. And you'll see here that as you go up section in the basin, that the elevation increases from approximately 900 meters to almost 2,000 meters up at the top of the stratigraphic column that has plants in it. So one of the things we can do, given that we have this nice dated section and we also have elevation estimates, is we can calculate an uplift rate for this area. Oh, and I'll just point out, sorry that I forgot this, that the error bars that are shown here are actually wider than 337 meters. And the reason for that is that I estimated elevation from an estimate which had an error associated with it. And so I calculated out a new error for these. These error bars are almost 600 meters, which is a lot bigger than either the error you would get with temperature alone or the error you would get with just the elevation estimates alone. So I can calculate uplift rate here. And the uplift rate is different depending on whether you use the 12 million year old date down here or the 11.6 million year old date. But what you end up getting, basically, is if you use the 12 million year old date, the uplift rate during the deposition of the basin is 1.4 millimeters per year, plus or minus 1.4. And if you use the 11.6 date, and this with the 12.0 date, that would be over 0.8 million years. Use the 11.6 date, what you end up with is an uplift rate of 2.7 millimeters per year, plus or minus 2.9, and that would be over 0.4 million years. So either way, you can see that there has been uplift during this period of time. And granted, the error estimates on those uplift rates are high, basically because I had to take into account the error of the temperature and elevation both. But I will point out, as we're looking at this, that the fact that uplift could be occurring during this period is corroborated by other researchers who have been working in the Northern Andes and using geological proxy to determine elevation. For instance, Van der Weel and his colleagues have been looking at uplift rates in Colombia and found that for the period between 12 million years and about 9 million years, they saw increased rates of uplift during this period. And Sabin and his colleagues have found the same thing during the same 12 to 9 million year time period in Colombia. So I think what this shows, or what this might suggest, is uplift was indeed occurring here during the basin sedimentation, just like it was to the north and south of it. Alternatively, because we have an elevation estimate for the time period of the deposition of the Navón Basin, and we know what the present elevation of the basin is, we can figure out uplift rates and look at changes in elevation and temperature, and vegetation for that matter, since the basin has been deposited. So what I did here is I took those bottom three stratigraphic levels, all of which are in the same stratigraphic member and are deposited in the same type of sedimentary environment, and combined them together and got an average temperature and elevation estimate for those sites. And what I ended up with was an average elevation for those has increased since the during the deposition, and we've seen continued uplift since that period. I'll also point out today's vegetation was montane, like I mentioned earlier. And based on the elevation and temperature estimates that we've had from the Navone Basin, I'm going to suggest that the vegetation of this area was submontane vegetation. It wasn't montane like we see now, and it's too high and too cool to have been home to tropical lowland vegetation during this period. So first, I'll apologize that this slide is in Spanish. The English version didn't come out, so you get the early Spanish version. But what this basically shows is something similar to that slide I showed you earlier with vegetation types. And as you go through this, elevation increases, or you could also say the temperature decreases in this diagram. And there's also a precipitation component. But what we've talked about and what is shown here also is that as you go up in elevation, you go through different types of vegetation type. And so in the early Miocene, what we have is lowland vegetation. What I think we've got based on the elevation and temperature estimates of the Navone Basin is submontane vegetation. And today in this area, we have montane vegetation. What would be really nice, and what would be a great thing for me to do afterwards, I'd like to, is also, if you look on this graph, there's this precipitation component. So during the Miocene, where were we? Was it real wet there? Did we have submontane tropical, did we have submontane rainforest, or was it more desert-like in these conditions? And basically, we could go through this whole exercise again from the beginning, testing precipitation equations and trying to figure out the best way to estimate precipitation in this area. I think that would be a good future direction. So what we have are a couple of different types of conclusions. We have individual conclusions based on the questions that we asked throughout this talk, and I'll go over those now. You don't have to read all of these, obviously, but the first is that most published regression equations are unsuitable for predicting temperature of neotropical sites. And in particular, they are unsuitable for predicting temperature of the high elevation sites. And this is not to say that they're all bad for all sites in South America, but in general, published regression equations don't do a good job of estimating temperature for those neotropical sites. Secondly, a simple linear regression equation based on just percentage of species with entire margin doesn't seem to be suitable for predicting paleo temperatures of the neotropical sites that are high elevation and high rainfall. And so because of that, because I want to be able to make sure that if the Navone Basin was at higher elevations or at higher rainfalls, I've recommended that a multiple linear regression equation that I've calculated based on three different characters should be used to estimate paleo temperature. Thirdly, the paleo temperature of the Navone Basin has decreased over the period of basin sedimentation by about 6 degrees as you go up section. And at the same time, I think the reason that the temperature has decreased is because the elevation of that basin was increasing during that period of time. And we can calculate an uplift rate during that sedimentation, which indicates that uplift was indeed occurring during this period. And then finally, based on elevation and temperature estimates, the Miocene vegetation of the Navone Basin was probably not montane like it is now, but submontane. And I also think it probably wasn't tropical lowland like it would have been earlier in time. But we can also draw some broad conclusions from this, which is, you know, I looked at a time slice in the uplift history of the Navone Basin about 12 to 9 million years ago, which is halfway through when the uplift started and the present time. So what we could see by looking at this is that by the time of the deposition of the Navone Basin, uplift has occurred in this area. And the area is no longer strictly lowland. And we can see this by looking at the temperature and elevation estimates, showing that uplift has indeed occurred by 12 million years ago. And also, in conjunction with this, by comparing the elevation and temperature estimates to today, you can see that uplift has indeed continued since the deposition of the Navone Basin, and that there have been changes in vegetation since that period of time as well, and that the present elevation and temperatures were not achieved by 11 million years ago. So what I'll leave you with, since you just saw a whole mess of blue slides one after another, are two images of Ecuador. This is one of the tallest mountains in Ecuador. Who knows, uplift is still continuing in South America. Maybe Nabón will end up this high. This is a view on the way down to the Nabón Basin. And secondly, picture of my dad, the field assistant, hanging out with one of the local Nabón residents who wanted to share his room. So thanks, and I'll take questions. Before we start questions, I just want to remind those of you who may not have heard, there's a party at my house this evening to celebrate Beth's defense, and there's maps here. It's in Saline, so please take a map and see us there about 7:30. And does anybody have any questions? Yes, Mark.
You said you didn't use the nearest relative thing because most of them weren't identified. Are the ones that you know more particularly what they were, did they seem to fit in that they're typically so mundane or are they not that?
What I'll say with this is the given the tentative identifications on some of them and others that I think are more robustly identified, it's impossible to really say that, well, they don't contradict the temperatures and elevations that I've gotten from the leaf morphology data. The problem, I guess you could, it's not really a problem, but the problem with that is that for those particular species and genera, the range of tolerances is pretty broad. And so I could say, yes, they probably did occur in submontane, but I can't rule out that those particular species might have been lowland and other particular species montane. But in general, if you look at the whole range of the species that you see, you can't say that it wasn't submontane by looking at them. So. Yes.
I have a question, not it's related to your work, but it involves Africa. Jonathan Kingdon in his book, Island Africa, suggested that in the Miocene, there were times when it was considerably cooler in East Africa, and so the montane species that you see just at very high elevation now, in places like the Missouri, that are shared species between these different isolated mountains now, managed to communicate between these mountaintops by coming down only during these cool times. But in your presentation, you suggest that the plants that you find at these cool temperatures are also sort of limited to these altitudes. So I'm a little unclear of how his story works and how it fits with the conclusions you have. In other words, is it possible that he's wrong about how we get these species from one top to another?
Well, it's possible. I wouldn't say that he's wrong though necessarily. I think at high elevations in the Andes, what you're seeing is a period of uplift, and so plants that were present before the period of uplift may have evolved in place. And actually, Krunenberg and his colleagues have suggested that elevations in the Andes were too high by the time the land bridge was established between North and South America to say that all of the high elevation species came in from other areas that were at high elevations, and that basically the plants that were in place had to have started to modify based on their environment by then. And so I think there also during glacial periods, it has been suggested that temperatures were decreased at lower elevations in the mountains. And so if that is the case, you would be able to go from mountaintop to mountaintop during those periods. But that was sort of, they think, restricted to periods during the Quaternary when there was glacials, and so you would see that less. But the elevations were pretty high. I mean, in Colombia, by the late Miocene, you see elevations that are high enough that anything coming in over the land bridge or coming in from southern South America, where the elevations became higher earlier, could have come through them on those peaks, or at least, you know, along the top there. Yes?
Has anybody else calculated uplift and sort of timing uplift rates for that part of the Andes and how your rates are there?
Yes, actually they have, and using a bunch of different methods. I compiled the database, which I didn't show here, about 30 different uplift rates that people have done in that region. And one thing you'll notice is that depending on the time period you're looking at, you know, like as I did when I calculated the uplift rate only during the sedimentation, it was pretty high. And since the deposition of the basin was low, and those actually coincide with other uplift rates that have been calculated throughout that region during that period. So it's close. I mean, it doesn't raise any flags. Those rates don't raise any flags. Yes, Gary.
Was global temperature during the period of uplift that you're looking at more or less constant so that you can attribute changes in temperature to changes in elevation?
That's an interesting question, actually, and a very good one. The estimates at the equator in those regions in the neotropics, people have suggested that temperature may have changed in that region globally from the Miocene to today, but probably no more than 3 degrees Celsius. And so there probably is a component of that in the estimates I'm seeing, the changes in global temperature. But what I will say, two things. One is the magnitude of the change I'm seeing is much greater than global change and over a much shorter time period. So that what I think it is really the change in temperature is primarily due to uplift in that area, not necessarily the global change in rate.
For those of us who spent 30 years living in the world according to Jack Wolf, it seems like leaf margin analysis is not particularly useful. Or at least, I'm talking about, I'm asking about the leaf margin analysis that you didn't seem to find was particularly correlated. Is that because of the phylogenetic effect? Or because there's never been?
Would you repeat the questions?
Great. Greg's asking me if he was pointing out that Jack Wolf did a leaf margin analysis where he used percent entire margin species to predict temperature, and he's asking why that doesn't seem to work in South America, whether it's phylogenetic or something else. I think there's a lot of components to that. I think one component is probably that in South America it was isolated and you had lowland tropical forests during that whole period, and from all suggestions you would expect then to have lots of entire margin leaves, and then you have uplift pretty quick and still no connection to areas where there are lots of toothed leaves and they're coming in. But I think what you're seeing is probably a phylogenetic effect because the plants that were in place to begin with were adapted to warmer environments and then slowly are changing through time. Possibly the elevation hasn't changed enough during that period to influence the evolution of those plants as much. Secondly, I think you're also seeing that there's a short time period since connections between North and South America, which pull in lots of tooth species. And if you go now into these areas, some of the high elevation tooth species are things like alder, which came in from North America, and oak and other species that you would expect from, that you don't really find in older sediments. And there are probably a lot of other reasons too. It could just be changes, differences in rainfall, seasonality in those areas and things like that. So I'm not sure exactly why that is. I'll also point out that Jack Wolf now doesn't use leaf margin anymore. He uses the canonical correspondence and things, but because of the differences in different regions, you should, and things like biology, you should look at many different leaf characters. So he uses all 31 now. But it has been shown that for many areas of the world, especially in North America and parts of Australia and things, that leaf margin, just using the percent entire margin species against the monoculture, does work very well in certain areas. I just found that in South America it didn't seem to as well. Anyone else?
I have one question. You have 3 stratigraphic levels in the El Salado that are different in temperature, and I'm wondering if you think that those are, if that's a true reflection of temperature change, or what you think about those 3 sites that are, or 3 stratigraphic levels within the El Salado.
I think actually that they probably are mostly reflective of actual temperature change. And part of the reason is, one, they're in similar environments, so you would expect the types of species to be in, say, river environments versus forest environments to be similar, of similar morphologic composition. So I think a change in them that you see might actually reflect changes in the temperatures of those areas. And secondly, I think that the amount of time that you see in those, in the El Salado member, is much greater than you see higher up in the section, say in the ash bed sequences. And I think what's happening is you're getting small amounts of sedimentation or periodic sedimentation all the way through there, so that the amount of time represented between those layers is great, and that you could see the temperature changes through those, that period. Yes, Kat.
How, in thinking about submontane forests that you think might have been the original vegetation here, if you were to look at submontane forests today in South America, roughly how many species would you expect to find if you could, say, census a relatively large area, say a couple hundred square kilometers, or whatever would seem a reasonably large area to an ecologist?
How many species?
Yeah.
You would find in general?
Yeah.
I can't give a really great estimate of that. I will say that lowland areas in South America can have upwards of 350 tree species. And when you get up into the montane regions, the diversity decreases a lot. And so some of the areas that I looked at when I was compiling my data list, you would find maybe 150 or so species in the submontane regions, which is sort of in between, but depended also on the area you were in. So if they had low soil nutrients, you wouldn't expect as many species, even if you're at the submontane region. Or cloud forests, which can occur at many different elevations, that particular precipitation environment also might change. But I'd say, in general, you'd find maybe 100 species on the high end in the submontane forest.
There's no more questions. Again,